Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming this morning. It's a beautiful spring-like day in Tampa, Florida. In the past few weeks, our community, the Florida Community of Mindfulness, has begun a period of practice that we call intensive practices. Intensive periods of practice. And we have two quote-unquote intensives going on, and these are for people who, you know, live at home, lay people, have jobs, families, but want to be more deeply engaged and supported in their practice of awakening. So we have one intensive dealing with what's called the Four Immeasurables, and the other one is on the way of the Bodhisattva. And there are about 120 members of our community who are engaged in these two intensives. The intensive on the Four Immeasurables, the Four Immeasurables are about the Buddha's teachings on what we would call love. They are the teachings, the Four Immeasurables means they are boundless and cannot be measured in the good that they bring, both to the person practicing them as well as society. We're talking about the practices of loving kindness, compassion, joy in the joy of others, and equanimity, equality of how these three are distributed equally to all beings. I'm going to be talking more about the path of the Bodhisattva today, but let me just say, many people, they kind of think the practice of loving kindness, the practice of compassion are practices. They're simply practices we do. We say, may all beings be happy. So people think, oh, I'm practicing metta, loving kindness, because I say at the end of my meditation, may all beings be happy, may all beings be free of suffering. May all beings know the equality and the joy of the mind, so to speak. And that's a good beginning. But we're talking about a mind of love. The mind of compassion. The mind of kindness. It's a mind, not simply thoughts. See, thoughts come from the mind. It's not the other way around. And so, if we are talking about thoughts of love, thoughts of compassion, thoughts of taking joy in the joy of others, we're talking about a mind deeper than the thoughts from which these type of thoughts and this type of feeling arise. So, we are learning how to tap into this mind of love and make it our mind, you see. If it's only in the realm of thoughts, then we're always thinking, all right, what thought should I be thinking toward this person? Oh, I have a negative thought to them. Let me immediately say, may they be happy. Now, that's good. You know, that's better than, you know, wishing harm to a sentient being, to anyone. So that's definitely an improvement. But what if we didn't have to just be searching around for the right thought? Right? What if the condition of our mind was we lived in the mind of love and toward all beings, and all beings including family members, people we work with, you know, neighbors, you know, that's, you know, like they're all, you know, it's easier to kind of think about all beings. But often we leave out those people in our life, especially the ones that are a challenge. So please remember that when we talk about these four immeasurables, we're talking about developing the mind of compassion that is a natural mind. You see, there is something deeper than thoughts. It's hard for many of us to believe because we live in our thoughts. But it's like, what's it like? It's like, you see, we turn on our tap and out comes water, right? But we know that in Florida, our waters come from aquifers. The source of our water is not the faucet. That may come as a shock to some people, right? And the source of our water is not the water line. The source of our water are the aquifers, let's say, that are deeper than the functionality of the water pipes. That is the source. That source is innately pure. Pure water. But because of things that have gone on, right, various kinds of toxins may get into the water. Right? Salt intrusion may get into the water. And so the water that comes out of our tap may not be that pure anymore. Even though it began pure and is innately pure, it gets contaminated. In the same way, the natural goodness of our minds have become contaminated. With afflictive mind states. And so we need to return to the source. And it's through these practices that we can return to the source so we can eventually touch the source itself and develop a way for the natural goodness and openness and lovingness and kindness and compassion of our heart to naturally flow forth so it is our natural mind again. In Buddhism, we believe we have all beings have this natural awakened mind with all good qualities. When they are fully manifested, we call that a Buddha, a bodhisattva, an enlightened being. But enlightened being is really simply a human being like us who has returned to the source of their own minds and are living from that source and not from their contaminated thoughts. Now, for many of us, that's kind of revolutionary. Because we are so lost in thought, we are so identified in thought, and we so deal with life through our thoughts, through our belief, through our ideas. It's hard for us to believe, when we read the teachings over and over, that we have this natural goodness, this natural wisdom that's already here. It's not like we have to get it. And it is not the wisdom in books, even though there's a lot of wisdom in books. If there are the wisdom in books comes from people who have awakened to the wisdom of their own mind, you see, and then they put it into words. It's not the other way around. And so we want to use these words and these practices and the teachings to guide us to come home. And so in the intensive on the four immeasurables, we are returning home for the people in that intensive with these practices that help us generate this mind of love. And in Buddhism, it is clearly understood it needs to be practiced. You know, every religion, every kind of good way of humanistic way of being in the world will say, yes, what? Yeah, we should be kind to one another. We should be loving to one another. We should be compassionate to one another, right? I mean, that's common. But the technology of how you develop that mind is often lacking. So in Buddhism, there is a very clear path with a very clear set of teachings and practices that understand that this will not come about by itself, and it will not come about just for us wanting it or wishing it, reading about it or talking about it. Right? It needs to be generated and practiced. So again, people in that intensive on their four immeasurables are learning how to do that. Now, the other intensive that's going on is on this way of the bodhisattva. And again, I talked about this a little bit several weeks ago. I want to go into it more today since we are beginning this teaching. And the most deeply respected text in this tradition is called the Bodhicaryatara, Bodhicaryatara, written by the 8th century Buddhist Shantideva. Now, Shantideva, won't go into it much, but he was an interesting character. He was at the great Buddhist University of Nalanda in the 8th century. It's like the Harvard, the Yale of Buddha. It was a university. All of that, Stanford, it was all, Nalanda, right? And, all the great scholars, all the great practitioners, I mean, it was almost a city unto itself, were there. And then there was Shantideva. And, he was known around the monastery, I forget who, he was known for three things. Sleeping, eating, and, shitting. So that's what they all, he didn't come to the classes. I mean, he didn't, so he was, so all the other, monks and scholars, were kind of embarrassed and wanted to get him out, and they'd go to the abbot, and the abbot wouldn't kick him out. So they came up with a plan. There was a tradition that at a certain point of being in the university, in the monastery, at some point you would give a talk to your peers on the Dharma. And they thought, he's a complete idiot. We'll just invite him to give a talk. He'll reveal to everyone, he doesn't know anything. And then, they'll kick him out. So he's invited, make a long story short, this is what he said. And it has become, the most wonderful. It's also all in verse. Everybody should read this over and over. This should be one of our main texts that we take with us in this lifetime. So again, whether it's a true story, an apocryphal story, I think it has meaning, because usually if you were to think about, this great Buddhist teacher, Shantideva, his teaching has been just taught and so many commentaries written on, you'd think you'd have him as a great being. And yet here he was known as, as I've said, for the three things. And I think it's a very powerful teaching that, it's not how things look. We can look good. A Dharma teacher can look good. Can act good, can turn the right pages, read the right, read the right stuff, talk the talk, wear the right costume, but may not have the teachings truly penetrate and transform their heart and mind. Right? So Shantideva was that. He didn't look like a great Buddhist scholar. He definitely didn't look like a great Buddhist practitioner, because when everybody was in the meditation hall, he was sleeping, or he was in the toilet or something, or he's eating. He didn't look like he should, but yet he was, as we know, a greatly enlightened being. And so it's very important that we stay focused on the heart of things. The heart, that realization has to do with something that's absorbed deeply, within the heart and mind of a human being. So Shantideva's text, called The Way of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is the ideal of what's called Mahayana Buddhism, which is the tradition that we practice in, the great path of Dharma. And in Mahayana Buddhism, the ideal of what it means to be an enlightened person is called the Bodhisattva, the enlightened warrior, he or she of the enlightened mind, the Bodhisattva. And so this text, The Way of the Bodhisattva, is primarily a text about the practices that a bodhisattva undertakes to help them realize and awaken to their true nature, which in Buddhism are called the six paramitas, right? Morality, right action, generosity, patience, diligence, energy, meditation, wisdom, all these. So his text is primarily about the practices. But his first, this is what I want to begin today, and this is where in the intensive, he begins with a chapter called The Excellence of Bodhicitta. It's very interesting. Before he says anything about any kind of practice, any type of practice of generosity, patience, meditation, wisdom, before he gets into anything, he talks to people about this mind of bodhicitta. He calls it the excellence of bodhicitta. He wants to alert us quite dramatically that there is another mind that human beings can aspire to and live by other than our ordinary mind that we're used to, right? And he realized for most of us, and this is back in 8th century, that's a big leap. Because this mind and all its thoughts and all its likes and dislikes and all its neuroses and all its issues, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We think this is our mind, right? And, you know, our lot in life is to somehow, what? Make it a little better, right? To make it a little better. And the idea that, no, there's another whole mind that we could be cultivating and developing, which is radically different than this everyday ego-centered mind, is something we don't know about. So he begins, he says, I'm skipping around, in verse 5, he says, just as on a, this is very famous, just as on a dark night, black with clouds, the sudden lightning glares and all is clearly shown, likewise rarely virtuous thoughts arise, brief and transient in the world. So he sets forth the reality of our lives, right? Every now and then, a virtuous thought, a kind thought, compassionate thought, a generous thought, a patient thought will arise, right? And like the lightning in the dark, it will light things up for a moment, right? And we'll feel good. But like lightning, it will fade and things will return to darkness. And again, I think we understand that, that it doesn't mean we don't have good thoughts and kind thoughts, and altruistic thoughts. But they are kind of random, right? They arise, and then they're gone, and we return back to the usual self-centered, egocentric way of looking at life and dealing with situations and relationships. You know, every now and then we get out of ourselves, and when we do, it feels good. You know, in the same way for most of us, for many of us, you know, we go out into the world and we may do good things. We volunteer here, we do something there, you know, good things to make our world better or to help other people. But those, again, are episodic. They're not continuous. And then we come home and we resort back to our usual life, our usual mind states. Is that clear? So he's kind of just, he's just saying that it is. He says, virtue thus is weak because it's not developed. Our goodness is not developed. It's not strong. Our muscle of altruism is not strong, meaning it's on and off. But evil is of great and overwhelming strength. So when Buddhism says evil, for those of us with Judeo-Christian background, it's not that evil. When, I mean, again, somebody's translating a word. There's no word for evil in Buddhism, but what translates evil, it means all those thoughts and actions that do harm and bring harm to oneself or others. We might say that is evil. That all of these, there's only one mind state that has the power to overcome this small mind. and that is the mind of bodhicitta. For many eons, deeply pondering, the mighty Buddhas saw its benefits, whereby unnumbered multitudes are brought with ease to supreme joy. So he's saying that this is what enlightened beings are up to, right? They want us, all beings, to be happy. They want society to be filled with goodness, with love, with caring for one another, and taking care of one another, and feeling the pain of suffering of one is the pain of suffering of all, and to do no harm to one another, right? He understands, you know, that's what they want. And they ponder, how do we get human beings there? You see? How do we get them there? He says, all other virtues, like the plantain tree, produce their fruit, but then their force is spent. Alone, the marvelous tree of bodhicitta constantly bears fruit and grows unceasingly. So he's saying, like the plantain, the banana tree, once it puts out its fruit, you cut it down, right? Because it's done its duty. It's that in most of the case, our actions, our virtuous thoughts, our virtuous actions, only kind of live as long as the action. They're not continuous. The fruits of the action are only, you know, related to that one. The fruits are only related to that one action, right? So we may be kind to our loved ones. We may do a kind act for a friend, a compassionate act. We may do something worthwhile in society, and that will have its effects. But the effects will last only as long as the causes that have made them. Is that clear? And then they eventually will dissipate. And we know, if we look at our world, it is a world where many, 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 many people have done and continue to do good deeds. True? No. And yet we see that the world seems to continue on a path of what? Of the opposite, creating suffering. Why is that? Because our virtuous and good deeds are episodic, they're not continuous. And that's what the, you know, has been pondered. Why is that so? So now he comes, he says, bodhicitta. Now, bodhicitta is this, it has two meanings. It means the awakened mind, bodhi mind, but it also implies those who want to awaken to their awakened mind. Right, so it is both the goal, but it is both you know, the action of the person who wants to achieve that goal, as well as we've just heard, the purpose of undertaking the cultivation of that awakened mind is to benefit society. Right, that's what the Buddhas are pondering. You know, the Buddhas aren't just thinking about themselves. You know, how can I free myself from my own suffering and my delusions and my self-centeredness, you know, and be liberated from my suffering? If that was the purpose of Shakyamuni Buddha, we would not be here today. Right? We would not be here today because he resolved it for himself, didn't he? In his great awakening. He liberated himself in his great awakening. But because his undertaking of that was also to bring benefit to everyone, he, for 40 or 50 years afterwards, shared with, you know, anyone and everyone who would listen to him, so to speak. So this bodhicitta and a bodhisattva is one who is walking the path as well as achieve the path, is someone who wants to liberate themselves from all their constricting narrowness of selfishness and delusion and suffering. They want to awaken all the inherent positive qualities of their natural Buddha mind. Why? In order to help others do the same. So So this, the message here is one not just about individual transformation, but the transformation of the world at its most essential. Its most essential is what? Human beings. This world is created by human beings, right? All societies are involved with human beings. History, when we study the history of human beings and what they've been up to. Right? So even though we may have 6 billion, the 6 billion bodies are doing what they're doing because of 6 billion minds. And if those minds are in a state of delusion and egocentricity, where they can't see beyond their own narrow interests, we will create that type of world. On the other hand, if those 6 billion minds, or at least a significant number of them, are living from a very different mind and mind state that is continuous, right? Then we have a very different world. So he says, bodhicitta, the awakened mind, is known in brief to have two aspects. First, aspiring bodhicitta in intention, then active bodhicitta, practical engagement, as corresponding to the wish to go, and then the setting out. The wise should understand respectively the difference between these two. So there is this bodhicitta in intention, you know, this desire to set out. So the first thing is, do we really get it? You see? Do we really get it? There is another whole way of living and being in this world. There, because if you think about what we're doing all day, in our actions of our mind, our thoughts, our emotions, in the actions of our words, our speech, and in the actions of our body, this is how we manifest in the world. Do we want to manifest in the world in the actions of our body, speech, and mind in a totally healthy way? That's the first thing. Do we have that intention? Is it really our intention in everything we do to always bring benefit to others? Is this our intention? Is this our intention throughout the day? Never to do harm to anyone. Right? And in all the actions of our life, our actions of our body, speech, and mind, do we have the intention of only creating good, support, kindness, love, being of help, being generous? You know, do we want to give? Do we see everything we have? Our healthy body, if we have a healthy body. Our healthy mind, if we have a healthy mind. All the attributes of our mind. Our energy, our time, our financial resources. Do we really see all the things that we have that make us up as things we want to use to benefit others and not just myself? So this is a very different mind that he's talking about. And the first thing he's saying, you know, can we even comprehend this mind? And are we interested in it? Are we interested in it? And if we get really interested in it and convinced that we have it, you know, do we have the intention to generate it? That's like, you know, the intention to set out on a journey, on a different journey in life. So that's what he's talking about. And then he says, then there's bodhicitta that is active. He called it active bodhicitta. Right? Active bodhicitta means that now I am actively engaged in the practices of these 6 paramitas. See, I'm actually engaged in really cultivating generosity. And that's, again, another whole talk or two. I'm actively involved in generating patience, uprooting anger and frustration. I'm actively involved in in the actions of my body and my speech, only doing good. You know, it's called shila, or right action. You know, I am diligent, I am energetic, joyfully in my life and all the actions that I do. And I'm obviously cultivating a meditative life and cultivating wisdom. Right? So that's the practical engagement, he's saying. First we need the intention, and then we need the practical engagement in the development. Again, it is like, you know, I have the intention, you know, so many suffering people, suffering from disease, I generate the intention, I'm going to be a doctor. Okay? That's the intention. That's the aspiration. That's going to fuel what? 12 years of very difficult medical school. You see? That's the practical engagement. At the end of which process, I am what? Let's say I'm a physician, I'm using that example. I now have the capacities to be of benefit to sick people. Right? See, if I had just, you know, 12 years ago gone, I have the intention to help sick people. Right? So I'm going to go rent myself a little storefront, you know, office somewhere, put out my shingle and say, you know, I'm here to help sick people. Right? What do we call that? Quacks. You know, so you can have a good intention, right? That's a good intention, but you don't have the capacity. How do you develop the capacity? Well, you've got to develop the capacity. That's the practice. The practice is six paramitas, many other practices that we involve ourselves in. So at the end of which, we really have the capacity to really heal and transform human beings because we know what ails them. You see, we know what ails them. We know the sickness. We know the sickness of egocentricity. We know the sickness of alienation. We know the sickness of depression and anxiety and addiction. You know, we know all the sicknesses of human beings. And we have learned through our own process of how to liberate ourselves from those illnesses as well as we're able to manifest in a healthy, consistently healthy way in our life. For when with irreversible intent the mind embraces bodhicitta, this altruistic mind, willing to set free the endless multitude of beings, in that instant from that moment on, a great and unremitting stream, a strength of unwholesome merit, even during sleep and inattention, rises equal to the vastness of the sky. Shantideva is a poet. This is all in verse. It's a mind, you see. It's not just thoughts. For many of us, you know, again, we have altruistic thoughts, we have altruistic intentions, but we revert back. We're on and off. It's like an on and off switch. So we're talking about something that is constant and consistent, a wonderful mind. Then he says, if with kindly generosity one merely has the wish to soothe the aching heads of other beings, such merit knows no bounds. So he's making a point here. He's saying, you know, if a worldly person such as us, you know, has the wish to soothe the aching heads of people, we would say what? Wonderful. Great merit for wanting to kind of help everybody who has headaches. That's wonderful. Then he says, no need to speak then of the wish to drive away the endless pain of each and every living being, bringing them unexpounded excellence. So he's saying, if society thinks that somebody who does an altruistic action has great merit, it brings great benefit, how much to a human being who has the intention and the ability to liberate all beings from their pain and suffering, everyone they're encountering, right? Isn't this something extraordinary? Could our father or our mother ever have so generous a wish? Do even the very gods harbor such benevolence as this? For even in their past, even in their dreams, wish something like this even for themselves. No. How could they do so for another's sake? Right? So he says, how many beings actually for themselves say, I want to free myself from all my suffering. I'm sick of it. I want to free myself from all my constriction, all my narrowness, all my pettiness. I want to free myself from all my issues, all my conditioning. See, he's saying, how many people even generate that wish for themselves? How many do you think? You've been around. You've been around. How many people? I mean, a lot. Even the people who just want to improve themselves, you know, the self-improvement, right? I mean, that's a minority, right? So there are many people who want to improve themselves. But how many people actually want to free themselves from their suffering and become the type of human being they're really capable of in this world? He's saying, you know, that's few. So how about somebody who not only can wish that for themselves, but to wish that for all beings? The same to bring about the benefit of beings, a benefit that others wish, not even for themselves, this noble jewel-like state of mind arises truly wondrous, never seen before. So again, in this first chapter, again, you know, it's a mixed audience today. Some of you have just come in for the first time. Many of you are kind of checking things out. Many of you are kind of coming because you're interested in learning meditation, mindfulness. All wonderful. Okay, but you know what we are being exposed to here in this text is something. Again, as he said, it is not something that was talked about when we were growing up at the dinner table at night. When the extended family got together for Thanksgiving or Christmas, this is not what we talked about, was it? No. So we have to realize this mind of enlightenment is unique, and this path to it is unique. We are very fortunate that this text still lives and there are still people practicing this way. Because in this bodhisattva path is unified something that very much, even in religious life, is very separate. Right? So in religious life, in religious path, the idea that of doing good deeds, right? That this is important. This is the path, right? To be good to one another, to be kind to one another, right? So this is kind of one kind of path, religious spiritual path in life, cultivating the heart. Then there's another path. The path of wisdom, understanding things really as they are, the path of profound philosophy and psychology, the path of again, understanding the nature of reality, the nature of things, the nature of mind, the nature of self, and all the meditative techniques that help one do that, right? So often that is seen as like two different paths, right? In this path, they are united. It's a very unusual path. Because it actually says that when compassion, loving kindness, etc., the path of the heart and the path of the mind and wisdom are absolutely united, then you get a complete being. You see? And that compassion without intelligence, without wisdom, is often misguided. Right? We can have a desire to end suffering for ourselves or society, but not really know how to look deeply to see the causes, right? We often don't see the causes within ourselves of why we suffer, right? Why is that? Because we don't have wisdom. We don't have that deep wisdom of understanding the nature of our own minds and our own suffering, right? So when they are brought together, as they are brought together in this path, it is something very special. Right? And I don't say this as a, you know, as a huckster. You know, I'm not working up here on commission. To be honestly, I'm somebody who, way back in my 20s, when I first got an early translation of this text, which was nowhere as beautiful as this, it's just like the light went on. Wow. What a path in life. You know, these two paths of the inner path of meditation and cultivation of wisdom and insight, concentration, mindfulness, and the path of love and service, the path of the heart, same path. Right? What a vision in life. Right? What a vision to inspire one's life. And what a template to teach us how to enter all the activities of our life, including our most intimate relations. We have the kids here today, right? And just let me read a few more lines. I've read these before. And I will read them again, because they are so wonderful. You know, Pacho Rinpoche, he was a great enlightened teacher in Tibet in the 19th century. He taught this text over 100 times. And usually when he would teach it for months at a time. You know, a different time, right? I mean, he'd come to a nomadic area of Tibet, or a kind of valley where there are a number of villages and maybe a monastery, and he'd teach it, and everybody would come, right? Not just the monks and the nuns, but all of them, the lay people, the nomads, they'd all come and listen. And for months, he would teach this wonderful text, and it said that, you know, afterwards, even, you know, young children would be reciting little verses of it. I mean, how wonderful, right? What a wonderful time it must have been. So he taught it 100 times. So that tells us something. And now it says, if the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas. So he's saying, again, I think all you get it. You know, many people, religious, spiritual is about, you know, worship, earning merit, doing good deeds, praying, you know what I mean? Those kinds of quote-unquote religious actions. If the simple thought to be of help to others exceeds in worth the worship of the Buddhas, what need is there to speak of actual deeds that bring about the weal and benefit of beings? You know, so the actual undertaking of the ability to heal and transform human beings, to let them see why it is they suffer. Oh, let me just read the next line, then you'll understand. And the famous lines. They should really be kind of up somewhere. So please listen carefully. For beings long to free themselves from misery. Is that not true? All of us, everybody we know, the people out of Nebraska Avenue, right? Walking up and down, panhandling, selling drugs, prostituting themselves. All of them want what? To free themselves from misery, just like us. For beings long to free themselves from misery. That is like so fundamental to the human condition. We want to free ourselves from misery. But misery itself they follow and pursue. Right? All of us want to free ourselves from our misery, our unhappiness, our conditioning, our neuroses, our issues, right? We all do. And yet, we often end up living life involved in things that not only don't liberate us from our misery, but actually what? Create and continue that misery. They long for joy, but in their ignorance destroy it as they would their foe. So there is this paradox, and it's especially true in our society. We are frenetic in our doing, aren't we? Always doing, 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 doing. Because we want to do good. We want to be happy. We want to lead meaningful lives. And yet, at the end of the day, we often find ourselves in truth more or less in the same place. Is that not true? So the reason we are not free, open, happy, spacious, loving, selfless human beings after all our effort is not because of not trying. We have exerted great effort. Has not society, if you look at history, at least in the last 100 years, hasn't made great efforts been made to end war, to end poverty, to end injustice? Of course there have. And yet what? And yet what? Still there. We're surprised that it's even stronger than ever. How can that be with all these efforts we've made? We need to think about that. But those who fill with bliss all beings destitute of joy, who cut all pain and suffering away from those weighed down by misery, who drive away the darkness of their ignorance, what virtue could be matched with theirs? What friend could be compared to them? What merit is similar to this? So he is saying, right? For us to be able in this world to find a path that actually leads to the end of suffering, to actually find teachings and practices that, if put into effect, will actually end our misery. Isn't that something very special and precious and worth embracing? And if we have embraced that and practiced that and rid ourselves of these limitations and these afflictions, what better thing to do than to bring that to others? Wouldn't that be the height of selfishness for us only to think of freeing ourselves and not freeing others? We're all in this together, right? We're all interconnected. The misery of the world is a collective misery. We want the happiness of the world to be a collective happiness. How do we do that? Right? The last year in the history of human history, I'm leaving out Cro-Magnons, I'm leaving out the dinosaurs, you know, I'm leaving out many other, you know, we have a very kind of narrow view of history of this planet. You know, the human experiment is fairly recent. In the history of our planet, there are many more life forms on this planet than human beings. In the last 100 years, we've been in this great experiment, thinking that we can produce human happiness through what? Right? Through systems, through legislations, through systems. And yet, you know, we have to look deeply. Is that really the way? Is that really the way? How do we produce a world, a society, you know, that cultivates goodness in sentient beings, that really helps one another, that really frees people to open up to one another, to care of one another, love one another? How do you create that world? See, that's something to look deeply into. So this is an ancient text that is giving us a way how we can immediately begin this process of healing ourselves and healing the world. We don't have to wait. We don't have to be dependent on anyone else. We have a few minutes before we hear the kids. Any questions? Everybody clear how to proceed? So this is the first chapter. The first chapter is getting us to just get this, you know, this bigger picture. Then the rest of the text is really going chapter by chapter in terms of the practices, what to do, what this journey looks like. But in the beginning, there's this really important thing is, to, you know, what is my intention in this life? What is my aspiration? What do I think it really means to be a human being? What am I capable of? Is this one of those embarrassing silences, or does this mean everybody's kind of good with it? If you have any questions. Yes, John.
I don't actually have a question, but I wanted to thank you for this deeper explanation of this chapter, because when I read that, it wasn't really clear about it, and I got stuck on that one verse that I was trying to find.
Right. I mean, that verse you talk about human beings, and it's such a powerful verse, I think, because it's so true. We work so hard to be happy and free ourselves from misery everywhere. And yet, for all our efforts, all our exertions, we seem only to create more problems. Right? We enter relationships because why? Why? Why do we enter relationships? Because we think what? I see Rick nodding his head. Because why? Be happy. And yet we often find what? It's become suffering. We move here, we work here, right? Why? Because we think it'll make us happy. And yet we often find, one, over time it doesn't, and two, here we go again. Right? So many of the things we do not produce what we hope they'll do. So many of the little activities we do in our day, in our life, in our weekends, we do them because we think they'll make us happy. And the happiness they often produce is just short-term happiness. It doesn't really give us the happy mind. The happy mind that is not dependent on anything outside itself. That is a very different mind than the happy mind that is happy because things are going its way or it's set up a nice environment for itself. That's a very dangerous kind of happy mind. Because when those conditions are taken away, then what? What happens to our happy mind, our peaceful mind, our loving mind? Looking for another fix, yeah? And it will look, as you noticed. It will keep looking. That's, you know, because it wants to be happy. It wants to be free. It wants to feel good, right? You're exactly right. And at a certain point, we have to kind of, you know, listen to the wisdom of those wiser than ourselves. We are lucky. You know, this human race has produced wise people who've looked deeply into life, you know, for thousands of years. And so there's a great wisdom here that's available to us here in America, 2017, that we can utilize to get on with it. So good. Thank you.